On the 15th of August, 1947, Britain gave up its Indian Empire, partitioning it into two newly created independent countries, India and Pakistan. The 7 days leading up to the handover of power were some of the most tumultuous of the 20th century.
One of the really dark mysteries at the heart of partition is why ordinary people could turn into killers.
By the end of the week, one of the biggest migrations in human history had begun. This is the story of eight ordinary people, told in their own words, as they took part in an epic event that changed the world forever.
Somehow, all these leaders had convinced themselves that this enormous, nation-breaking, continent-splitting project could be managed without vast loss of life, without vast crisis. And of course, they were wrong.
7 days in summer. Countdown to partition. The stories in this programme are based on survivors' recorded testimony. The events they describe have been dramatised using photographs. A map of India.
By 1947, India had been ruled by Britain for almost 200 years. It was known as the jewel in the crown, supplying raw materials, a workforce, taxes, and brave soldiers. But Britain's dominion in India, her once beloved Raj, was about to dramatically end.
Today, responsible citizens of the world concerned with global politics are watching with intense interest the land of India, most difficult administrative problem of the British Empire, and home of one of the oldest and most complex of existing civilizations.
Archive footage.
For decades, Indian leaders like Mahatma Gandhi had been calling for independence, but Britain had always resisted. Now, World War II had left Britain bankrupt.
The British are in a real rush to leave India by this week. There's no money anymore to invest in this empire, and it's a waning asset. It's not actually paying for itself anymore as a colony. In fact, it's costing the British money to keep it going.
Lord Louis Mountbatten, the Queen's uncle, was sent to Delhi as the last viceroy.
Mountbatten was sent out to effect a peaceful and rapid transfer of power. But in reality, it wasn't like that at all, because on the ground, there was already quite a lot of violence occurring between the main religious communities.
Mountbatten was known in the Admiralty as the master of disaster because he was so good at wrecking ships. The fact is, they sent him to India because he seemed like a man who was incredibly good at PR. He was very good at doing a job where Britain would look good at the end of it. And so his task was to get Britain out and still looking as clean as possible.
For centuries, Hindus, Muslims and Sikhs had shared the country. But with British rule weakening, conflict had erupted between the Hindus and Sikhs on one side and the minority Muslims on the other. Mountbatten tried in vain to broker a deal that would keep India united. But the Muslim League, a political party led by British-trained barrister Muhammad Ali Jinnah, demanded a separate homeland for Indian Muslims. Fearing civil war as tensions grew, Mountbatten reluctantly drew up a plan for partition that would carve two new nations out of one. In just 7 days, Jinnah will become leader of the world's first Muslim country, Pakistan. And Jawaharlal Nehru will become the first prime minister of an independent India.
Imagine being an Indian the week before independence. You've been waiting 20 or 30 years, your whole life, been dreaming of it, fantasizing about what that might mean. And now, independence, this week, is actually going to happen. But for the people on the ground, it looks completely different. They are dealing with bloodshed, uncertainty, rumours, anxiety. So there's a real disconnect between what's happening in Delhi and what people are actually experiencing.
In just 1 week's time, everything will come to a head. As ever, the powerful stand to profit, but ordinary people will find their lives thrown into turmoil. As millions will have to choose which country they want to call home.
Friday, 8th August, 1947. 7 days until partition. A hazy sunrise in the countryside.
With just 7 days to go until partition, the British still haven't announced where the border will be drawn. But it's clear that Punjab, a region in India's north where Muslims, Sikhs and Hindus live alongside each other, will be divided between the two new countries. Riaz Khan, a young Muslim schoolboy, knows nothing about the power games being played out hundreds of miles to the south in Delhi.
I was a young boy. Early one morning, my parents' voices echoed through our home. Get out, quickly, move. Something of great significance seemed to be happening, though I did not understand what. I was told we were going to what would be Pakistan. I didn't know what this meant or why we had to go.
The Punjab is a very large region. The United Punjab was slightly larger than the United Kingdom. And Hindus, Muslims and Sikhs were really peppered all the way through it. They weren't split into specific communities. So the idea of carving it up, even between those interests, is extremely difficult.
Riaz Khan's family are Muslims. They have heard a rumor that the area around their home may be in India rather than the new Pakistan.
Ordinary people had absolutely no clue as to what was going on. Imagine being in a village, you know, where your access to news is so limited. What would come to you would be by word of mouth, hearsay, rumor. And there were so many decisions to make. Would they stay where they are? Would they be traveling? Where would they be traveling to?
Riaz Khan's parents have heard rumors about attacks on Muslims in nearby villages. They don't want to leave their home, but are afraid for their lives.
My grandfather refused to leave. He owned the land and felt comfortable there.
I mean, it's really hard to imagine now what it must be like to say to somebody, you've got to go and leave everything. Leave your house, your property, your friends, your community, everything. Older people, especially, are quite often digging their heels in and they say, well, I've been here all my life. Why should I leave? My ancestors are buried here. This is the land that I've tilled. I'm not going to move. But others are leaving because of anticipation of violence and because of sheer uncertainty about what's happening and what's going on. It's heartbreaking for people to be making these decisions. They had to leave property behind, they had to leave families behind, and just embark on an unknown journey. It must have been absolutely traumatic.
My grandfather, he believed he would see us all in a couple of days because everything would return to normal and we would return home.
Many people imagined they would come back, so they left their keys with their neighbors, buried things in their courtyards, and they said, right, I will come back. I'm just going temporarily for safety. But of course they didn't. They never came back.
I never saw my grandfather again.
Riaz and his family have distant relatives in a Muslim area about 120 miles northwest. They have decided to head in that direction.
I remember seeing a stream of people moving out of the village. We joined them and started walking.
Millions of natives left their homes to move to an area where their religion was honored. Muslims poured into Pakistan, and Hindus caught within the borders of the new Muslim nation migrated to the new India. For many, the move meant uprooting their lives. But no sacrifice was too great to make for their religious freedom.
Nobody had a clue that there would be this exodus. Some said, well, there'll be a few thousands moving here and there. Mountbatten said some of the educated might leave. But the scale of the movement was absolutely unforeseen by everybody involved in the partition. There are 12 to 15 million people on the move. It's one of the biggest refugee migrations of the 20th century.
More and more families joined that caravan.
Riaz and his family can only hope there will be safety in numbers.
We believed men were lying in wait to attack us. Any noise frightened me.
Imagine what it's like to be one of these refugees. They're trudging miles and miles along these hot, dusty roads. There are rumors that the wells have been poisoned, so it's hard to get water. People are giving birth along the road, people are dying along the road, and constantly over everything is this fear that the other side are going to swoop down and attack while you're passing through their territory.
Mountbatten had promised the Indian leaders that he would provide security on the ground in the run-up to independence. But the Punjab Boundary Force, the British-led contingent dispatched to maintain law and order for a population of over 12 million, consists of just 15,000 men.
Dr. Yasmin Khan.
The boundary force goes out and it does try and stem and quell violence where it occurs. And when it shows up, it is effective in stemming the violence, but it's just too little, too late. At the same time, there are thousands of soldiers in India kept behind barracks. And the reason is the British fear that if they put too many troops into this situation, they won't be able to get them back out again.
The British are not saying anything. They're not interested. They're ready to get onto their boats and planes and be back in Britain. There is absolutely no instruction, no orders, no directions coming down from the British. They have washed their hands of India.
I saw the body of a dead man. It was the first thing like that I ever saw. I couldn't stop looking.
Some people are moving literally because they're running for their lives. Their friends have been attacked, so they're really on the run. But others are far more moving along ideological lines. People are thinking, do I believe in this new state enough to go and risk moving there? Am I really going to have a better job there? Are things really going to be as bright as the propaganda is suggesting?
Refugees walking a dusty road.
Riaz Khan and his family walk all day. As night approaches, they reach a riverside, hoping to catch a boat to what would soon be Pakistan.
By the time a boat arrived for us, it was quite dark. There were dozens of people shoving and pushing. I was almost thrown in. Suddenly, the boat started to move, and my family could not get in. I was alone. I started crying. I thought it was my fault that I had lost them.
Who would have thought that independence, which is such a positive thing that people were waiting for, would have come along with this kind of experience? The political solution was what they were pushing for, but they had not, absolutely not anticipated the human costs that were to follow.
A photo of a huddle of people on a boat on a dark river, softly illuminated by lanterns. Saturday, 9th August 1947, 6 days until partition. Refugees loading up a truck.
With 6 days to go before independence, refugees are still trying to get to the country they want to belong to. The man responsible for drawing the boundary has only been in India for a month. Cyril Radcliffe, a wealthy British establishment lawyer, is running out of time.
So Cyril Radcliffe was actually a barrister who had no previous knowledge of India and no previous knowledge of drawing boundaries or borders in any context whatsoever. And in his own words, he spent almost his entire time sweating it out in India, not enjoying the Indian food, but having to decide one of the most important and momentous boundaries in world history.
Cyril Radcliffe is given this huge responsibility and actually has no experience of India. But interestingly, this is precisely why he is chosen, because he doesn't know anything about India and therefore seemed to be neutral. One of his first jobs is to actually get on a plane and see the country that he is actually going to divide and say, well, this is where the line should go down. But of course, it's not as simple as that.
So Cyril Radcliffe, the man who had spent 40 days in Delhi drawing up this partition, knew that there was a problem. He wrote a few days before independence, there will be roughly 80 million people with a grievance looking for me. I do not intend them to find me. And a couple of days after partition, he was on a plane back to England and he was never seen in India again.
Today, Lahore, ancient capital of Punjab, is almost exclusively Muslim and one of Pakistan's wealthiest cities. Back in 1947, the city was one of the most contentious decisions facing Cyril Radcliffe. When he divided Punjab, who would get Lahore?
Lahore was the Paris of the East. It was a beautiful, culturally mixed and impressive city that has been celebrated by poets for generations. But the whole place has Muslims, Hindus and Sikhs threaded throughout it, everywhere. Often they describe each other as brothers. And people can't even imagine how you might take apart this mixed hybrid population and segregate it out on religious lines.
The uncertainty over the boundary is setting different religions against each other in Lahore. watching the chaos unfold in a city he's always loved, is the Hindu writer Fikre Thanvi.
Last evening, a bomb exploded in a cinema house. Crimson red flames and flying sparks helped to illuminate the darkness. All the dead, 50 people, were Muslims, so indisputably the man who threw that bomb must have been a Hindu.
A photo of the slim man.
Lahore is in a state of civil war. It's absolutely ravaged. There are random stabbings happening in the streets, so people would just be knifed in the back unexpectedly. And people are losing not only their property and their livelihoods, but they're also losing a whole way of life.
The fear and tension of the past days still infected the atmosphere. The air was full of suspicion and terror that made you think that everyone had a dagger or a bomb hidden on their person. At one point, I saw a man lying in the corner with his eyes open. The policeman was muttering, "These people have been warned so many times not to go through the localities where there is danger, but they don't listen."
There had been very little preparation for the amount of trouble there would be in Lahore. It's actually very close to where the border was going to be, not that anyone knew precisely where the border was going to be. So as you came up to Independence, there became a situation where you had 100,000 people trapped in the old city of Lahore, and the only people to defend them were a group of around 200 Gurkhas with one British captain in charge of them who was 20 years old. So the rioting began in that city, and really nobody could do anything to contain it.
Punjab has a highly mixed population, with large numbers of Hindus and Muslims in every town and district. But Punjab is also the birthplace of the Sikh religion, and Sikhs make up 15% of the population. As a minority group, the Sikhs are not being given their own state. And now, some Sikh extremists are embarking on a mission to derail partition.
The most dangerous community in this whole mix was the Sikhs, because the Sikhs were the most vulnerable. Any border you drew was going to divide their community in half.
For them, the division of Punjab is a tragedy of epic proportions. They feel they've been really let down and cheated on by the British. And so there are some people who are just not going to accept it, and they fight it tooth and nail.
This morning, the Sikhs are targeting one of a series of special trains leaving Delhi. Pakistan does not have enough civil servants to run a government. 6 days before they start running their new country, a train packed with hundreds of Muslim bureaucrats and their families is on its way to what will be the new Pakistani capital, Karachi. The Pakistan Special's route passes straight through the Punjab, the ancient Sikh homeland.
Interspersed with footage taken from a train are photos of Sikh men hiding out in a rocky gully. They have a reel of cable and a pack of dynamite. A man's hand rests on the twist handle of a detonator. Now a photo of the wreckage of the derailed train lying on its side.
The Sikh bombing of the Pakistan Special kills 4 people, but its significance far outweighs the death toll.
The attack on that train really symbolises an attack on the whole of the new Pakistani state. And it was the first time that a train has been derailed and blown up. And it really ratchets up the situation. It really creates even more tension in an already terrible situation.
Sunday, 10th August, 1947. 5 days until partition.
In Lahore, there are just 5 days left before the last British governor of Punjab, Sir Evan Jenkins, hands over control to the two new independent governments. He spent much of his career administering a largely peaceful Punjab. Now, with time running out, he sends a telegram to Mountbatten pleading for help.
Situation now most serious. Rural areas reporting organized raids that cannot be checked except by display of force on massive scale. Amritsar rural area reports about 100 Hindus missing, believed murdered, and thrown into canal.
I think it was probably very difficult for a lot of the British on the ground at this time. A lot of them could see that this was going quite badly wrong. Not only are the British leaving, but those who remain are increasingly not being listened to because nobody's really sure who's going to be in charge of any particular part of India or which part of India is going to be India or Pakistan or what is going to happen. So authority is really not very clear at this point.
A photo of a well-dressed couple.
Prakash Vanti and her husband are Hindus from Western Punjab who were looking forward to independence. They never imagined the violence that would come with it.
All the locals left their houses saying the Muslims were coming. So we left our home. We were scared.
Prakash Vanti's husband decides that they should hide and wait for help in a factory.
I said to my husband, I don't want to stay here. My husband reassured me the trucks from India would arrive to rescue us very soon.
The common understanding of the violence in the villages is that suddenly Hindus and Muslims picked up pitchforks and started attacking one another, even neighbors who'd lived side by side for generations. But that was only a small part of the violence. Really, what made the violence take off and expand and grow so large was that it was organized. There were small groups of militia bands, oftentimes ex-soldiers armed with weapons, that would go around from village to village, gather up other supporters, so a band of 50 might become 500, might become 5,000, then they would attack and they would wipe out entire villages.
There's a lot of arson, a lot of things being set on fire, villages are ablaze. It's really about establishing facts on the ground, because if you can lay claim to an area and say it's been cleansed of one community or the other, then you're, in a way, making a de facto stake to that territory.
Prakash Vanti does what her husband says. She sits and waits for the authorities to rescue them.
The trucks never came. A Muslim policeman came to the door.
The police really fall apart at this time and they collapse, often turning a blind eye when their own community is involved in instigating violence, or they are, even worse, actually taking part in the violence.
He said to give him whatever possession we had and he would let us go. We gave him all our money and gold. My husband returned to the room and said, they are taking the young girls away. They are going to dishonor you.
For women, partition is a tragedy of epic proportions because tens of thousands of women are raped and there's terrible sexual violence against women.
Women holding up their hands.
Women have really hard lives in India before independence. I mean, they are like property in many ways, but they're also the upholders of the family honour. And if women are raped or violated, that's seen as bringing not just shame on them, but on the whole community, on the whole society. And so it becomes a weapon of war used by both sides very extensively because the women themselves seen almost somehow as symbols of these new nation states. And so it's a horrific situation where women's bodies are actually being used to kind of mark out and create the new states.
My husband said, now they will dishonor you. If you agree, I will kill you myself. He didn't wait for my response.
The feeling that you might actually risk your women falling into the hands of the enemy and to the other was so shameful, such a taboo, that some men would rather kill their daughters or their wives than actually have them fall into the hands of the other.
There was a sense, a really profoundly misogynist sense, that a woman's chastity was worth more than her life.
Sometime later, Prakash Vanti wakes up. She is wounded, but her husband had failed to kill her. The killers had moved on.
They must have thought I was already dead.
Just outside the building, Prakash Vanti finds her family.
The Muslims had killed my husband and son.
Only a short time ago, Prakash Vanti had been looking forward to independence. Now it has cost her her family. She's not alone. The death and destruction in the week leading up to partition is spreading. dividing and destroying hundreds of thousands of families across Punjab.
I don't think the British had any idea about the scale of violence that was going to take place in 1947. So in that sense, the British really didn't understand, I don't think, the nature of the implications of what they were proposing in the partition of India.
Terrified that the killers will return, Prakashvanti has to leave the bodies of her murdered family behind and seek safety.
I went into another building. There were lots of people hiding.
The refugees of Punjab can look to no one for help. All they can do is wait and hope that the violence will somehow pass.
The fact is that some people did foresee this violence, but they weren't really in positions of power and they weren't really being listened to, and nor were the resources available for them to do much about it.
In 5 days, a new government will take over. Until then, the refugees have to rely on themselves. Hiding in a corner, Prakashvanti finds two girls who, like her, have lost their family.
They had no father or mother or uncles. I couldn't leave them. Later, when my wounds were being treated in a hospital, I was asked if the girls were mine. I said yes, they were mine.
A photo of the three of them wandering up a country path. Now a map of Pakistan.
Located on the banks of the Arabian Sea, Karachi is today one of the biggest and fastest growing cities in the world, Pakistan's leading financial and industrial center. Back in 1947, it was a very different place. The one-time fishing village turned port had just been named Pakistan's new capital, but it wasn't ready for independence. Nor was the rest of the soon-to-be former Raj. When Lord Mountbatten announced back in June that partition would take place in just 61 days, he shocked everyone, including his own advisors. Now, with the clock running out, thousands of details, large and small, are still up in the air.
Nobody's ever done anything like this before, and it's absolutely astonishing in its recklessness. There's no sense of how this is going to be done.
This whole process is a good example of just how difficult it is to split any political entity this big that's been held together for so long. It involved everything from the big questions of who is going to get how many fighter planes from the Indian Army, of currency, who is going to print it and how, to the smallest things, the police band, who is going to get which instruments from it.
We see the division of the army. We see some of the great treasures of the archaeological India being divided down to the actual beads on necklaces. We see the encyclopedias being divided sometimes by letter in the alphabet.
The pettiness is astonishing. I mean, rugs, ceiling fans, cutlery, pieces of stationery, boxes of paperclips. I mean, things were being counted out with forensic detail. There was a ratio of 4-1, India-Pakistan, because of the respective size of the countries. And so these things were being kind of carved out.
One of the most poignant elements of this moment is, where are the so-called insane going to go? There is a very major insane asylum in Lahore. You know, it has Hindus, Muslims and Sikhs. And it opens up this absurd bureaucratic debate. Do the mad, who have been certified as people who do not belong to society, should they also be now divided up as Indians or Pakistanis?
Monday, 11th August, 1947. 4 days until partition.
With 4 days to go until independence, Muslim extremists begin a series of attacks on Sikhs and Hindus in Lahore. Revenge for the bombing of the Pakistan Special. Punjab's British governor sends his daily telegram to Mountbatten.
Jenkins to Mountbatten, 11th August. Today, train attacked outside Lahore station. 6 or 7 non-Muslims murdered. Outrage, doubtless retaliation for derailment of Pakistan Special. Situation out of control. During last day, Lahore reports 18 Hindus stabbed, Two fatal, one unidentified corpse found. Situation seriously disturbed and likely to deteriorate.
News of the outbreak of revenge attacks on innocents is spreading, even to the furthest reaches of the country. Some 600 miles west of Lahore, on the border with Afghanistan, is Quetta. This quiet backwater of the Raj is largely populated by Muslims. Sundar Das Lalwani is a Hindu civil engineer sent there by the British to build a bridge. But trouble is on the way. A mob is scouring the area, looking for Hindus to kill.
A gang of Muslims came banging on the front door. They heard there was a Hindu inside. You know, when I heard about partition, I'd sent my family away to Delhi. When I heard the mob that day, I thought I'd never see them again.
What is so peculiar and unique for this time is the fact that almost everyone is drawn into this macabre narrative of violence. You know, the ordinary householder going about their business, the regular professional man, everyone is baying for blood. Everyone's out there on the streets and ready to attack the rival community.
I had a Muslim servant who looked after my horse. He opened the door.
Novelist Nikita Lalwani.
How do you know how you will react under this kind of pressure at a time of such great chaos where there's a total breakdown of law and order? You may never envisage that you could be someone who kills someone, and yet that is what happens.
The gang wanted to come in to look for me. But then I realized the servant wouldn't let them.
But equally, there are stories at this time of extreme bravery where people really put themselves on the line to protect people.
Eventually, the Muslim servant boy persuades the mob that there are no Hindus hiding inside. He said Lalwani, his master, had already fled Quetta that morning.
I never really spoke to him before then, except maybe an order. But now that Muslim boy had saved my life.
A photo of the servant running through a forest.
He guided me to a place he knew in the forest. He said the mobs wouldn't find me there. He told me to wait there for the night and then he left. I started to worry that he changed his mind and he'll come back with some Muslims to kill me.
Sundar Das's pensive face looking up as he waits. Tuesday, 12th August, 1947.
With hordes seeking escape from the danger areas, the railroad system of the Indian Northwest proved inadequate to the strain. Cars broke down and...
There's only 3 days to go until independence. Refugees converge on railway stations, desperate not to be caught on the wrong side of the border when the country is divided.
Partition, when it became inevitable, could have happened in a different way. It could have been more organized, could have been dragged over time, and people could have moved in a manner that was more safe and secure over a period of months and or maybe even a year. It was the rush of partition that created the tragedy, not just the partition itself.
600 miles away from his family, who have already escaped to Delhi, Sundar Das Lalwani wakes up in the forest.
I don't know how, but I managed to get some sleep.
Thanks to his Muslim servant, Lalwani has managed to avoid being captured by mobs out for revenge against Hindus. But now he must escape them once more if he is to get to a train that will carry him to safety.
I had no idea what I was going to do. I couldn't believe it when my Muslim servant came back. He told me I needed to get to the train station. And he said the only way I could get there safely was to pretend I was a Muslim.
It was hard for anyone, if you were faced with a mob from your own community, to resist that, even if you didn't want to participate in the killing yourself, for individuals to try and stand against this was virtually impossible. So the best they could do, and many, many people did do this, was to shelter friends or neighbors individually, try and get them away to safety.
Sundar Das, now wearing Muslim clothes.
I owed him my life. He said, good luck.
I find it very moving when I think about those individual acts of courage, because so much is being risked at that time if you decide to try and protect someone from the other side.
Dressed as a Muslim, Lalwani is able to survive the long journey south to reunite with his family.
I myself wouldn't be sat here in front of you right now if it wasn't for the fact that my grandfather, Sundar Das Lalwani, was saved by a Muslim boy who really risked his life in order to get my grandfather out of the country. I don't know why he did it, but it's an incredible act of bravery, and it's humbling whenever I think about it.
The rail network has always been seen as one of the great successes of Britain's Indian Empire. But now, with only 3 days before the Raj is finally over, trains are becoming the dark symbol of its chaotic end. This is when killers on all sides begin to discover that they provide the perfect means to identify and destroy the enemy.
The direction that you're traveling in gave off your ethnic identity. Because if you were traveling towards Pakistan, you must be a Muslim. If you're traveling from Pakistan towards India, you must be either a Hindu or Sikh. And this week leading up to independence is when train massacres really start in earnest.
Trains become the center of violence in this period, targeting people who are moving from one part of the country to another in the hope of safety, in the hope of being with their co-religionists. But this becomes the most perilous journey of their lives, and the carnage is excessive and complete and bloody.
The violence on the trains, it's absolutely horrific. These are contained spaces and people can't run out as they're attacked. The perpetrators just move from carriage to carriage, hacking people to death as they move along. And as the train pulled into its destination, almost completely the entire train would be full of corpses.
As the massacres spread, whether your train is attacked or reaches its destination safely is just a question of fate. Harbhajan Singh Puri is a young Sikh government engineer, one of the lucky ones who makes it to safety.
I left Lahore by train. The violence had started. Stabbings, bombings. I got too scared to go out there. Even though my Muslim friend said they'd have to kill him to get to me.
When Harbhajan's train made it safely out of Lahore and beyond the reach of Muslim militias, he was relieved. But at Ludhiana station, north of Delhi, the violence of partition catches up with him. Harbhajan is forced to face the truth of how this week is changing people he thought he knew.
Some people started shouting, clear the train, everyone out. But they were looking for Muslims who might have been hiding in amongst us on the journey.
In the space of the train carriage, what happens is your identity became reduced largely to your religion. You might be a civil servant, you might be a teacher, you might be a gardener. But at that moment, you become a Hindu, a Muslim, a Sikh, a Christian. And I think that is a really important facet of the violence, because it reduced people's identities to that of religion. And it meant that they became targets for systematic religious violence.
I saw one young man. They questioned him and asked him, who are you? He gave some Hindu name. And they searched him. They found some papers which showed that he was actually a Muslim.
There are some people who don't agree that their identity is just about being Hindu, Sikh or Muslim. And there are people who are trying to bring peace, who are trying to bring people together. And they are just sort of drowned out, if you really, by the wave of hostility and violence that takes place.
He raised his arms to protect himself. His arm was all cut. And then they killed him. I hadn't seen such a sight before. It was shocking. I felt so sorry for him, but I couldn't help him. I just couldn't understand it. They were Sikhs like me. It was the madness that was around the people. Religious fanaticism, and then it's a vicious circle. It's a very sad thing. The partition of this country was a misfortune for humanity.
While many refugees were seeking sanctuary with family and friends, others had simply run away from danger and were now forming part of a rapidly escalating refugee crisis.
Hungry and homeless refugees set up housekeeping in the streets of the major cities. Bewildered, they waited helplessly for someone to take care of them.
With nowhere else to go, refugees across the country are being forced to live in makeshift camps that are struggling to cope with the influx.
The state of the refugee camps was really an example of how the British hadn't prepared for partition, but nor had the independence leaders. Nobody had really prepared for the level of disaster that was going to occur. And so the provision for refugees was incredibly basic. Quite frequently, there was no food, no water, certainly no medical supplies, and no security. So people found themselves still in immense danger of violence because there was nobody to protect them. Somehow, all these leaders had convinced themselves that it was not going to be as big a deal as it was, that it could be managed. This kind of enormous, nation-breaking, continent-splitting project could be managed without vast loss of life, without vast crisis. And of course, they were wrong.
13th August.
1,000 miles from Punjab, in India's east, is the other region that will be partitioned, Bengal. Today, the capital of India's half of Bengal is known as Kolkata. But back in 1947, the British called it Calcutta. 2 days before leaving India, they still have not announced who the city would belong to. Fueled by the uncertainty, Calcutta's Muslims and Hindus are preparing for all-out war. One of the leaders on the Hindu side is a wrestling coach named Jugal Chandra Ghosh.
I was a gunda, a thug. People were terrorized by me, but they used to love me as well.
Jugal Chandra Ghosh is a gunda, a gangster, who uses his wrestlers as muscle in the protection racket he runs in central Calcutta. Just 1 year ago, in August 1946, he took part in one of the most violent riots in Indian history. What began as a peaceful Muslim protest turned into 4 days of murderous street battles. Chandra Ghosh used his men as a Hindu killing force.
When I saw Hindu shops burnt and scattered Hindu dead bodies all around, I went down to the factories. I asked for money from them. They paid up. Then I declared to my boys, for one murder, you get 10 rupees. On my order, my boys, began the counterattacks.
So Calcutta was full of these gunda groups, both Hindu and Muslim. And till this point, they'd really operated more as an underworld mafia rather than as ethnic partisans. But this was the first time that they were used specifically as almost an ethnic militia. And you had sort of pitched battles in the streets between these two armed mafia groups.
I paid for at least 150 to 200 murders.
Back in 1946, at the end of what became known as the Great Calcutta Killings, 5,000 were dead. Now, with just 2 days to go before partition, Calcutta's newspapers are reporting that gunda gangs on both sides are getting ready to kill each other again.
When the police arrived, there was an exchange of shots between the two parties. Two armed constables were killed in this gunda police clash. The casualties among the miscreants is not known. The entire area was searched and about 24 bombs were recovered.
In this week, there's a fear that what happened in 1946 might happen again, that thousands of people might die again in Calcutta. And so people are on a knife edge. They're really feeling very, very tense. And there's the fear that one killing or one episode of violence might spark something that can't be brought back under control.
The fate of 400 million Indians rests on these men's shoulders. Iron-willed Muslim leaguer Muhammad Ali Jinnah. Here is silver-tongued Pandit Nehru,
It's only 2 days before the British hand over power to India's Nehru and Pakistan's Jinnah. But they can only watch events in Bengal and Punjab from afar, powerless.
Nehru and Jinnah are about to become leaders of these new countries and to have control of them. But actually, they're worried about the states that they're going to inherit. Everything that these men had fought for their whole adult lives was now coming apart at the seams. So they are really traumatized, these leaders, by what's happening. But they just keep going, really, because what else can they do? The agreement has been made with the British. Independence is coming, come what may, and they have to just keep plowing ahead.
Fearful that Calcutta will explode once again in civil war, the Chief Minister of Bengal turns in desperation to the only man he believes can help. 77-year-old Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi decides that Gunda leaders like Jugal Chandra Ghosh will be the key to stopping the cycle of violence in the city.
I was not a Gandhian at that point in time. But Gandhi's secretary came to see me. He said Gandhi would like to meet some of the influential people of the area later that afternoon.
Gandhi's technique of non-violence had never really worked against the British and really had fallen out of favour in the previous few years. Gandhi had fallen out of favour. By 1947, he really was rather a sidelined figure, but he still did believe in non-violence.
I went to see Gandhi. When he started speaking, there was pin drop silence all around.
By this stage, that older Gandhian story of using non-violence as a powerful tool is no longer washing with people. They're no longer really buying it.
Well, Gandhi started telling how we should stop killing. Some of us would die, but the riots would stop. He said, if we keep thinking that we must repay murder with murder, then this would never stop.
At this point, he's really having a dialogue. He's having a debate with some of the Gunda leaders about what the right course of action should be. And they are saying, well, come on, we have to fight. It's our duty to fight. But Gandhi is always, as always, absolutely adamant that non-violence and peace is the only way.
A few did not listen. They cursed Gandhi, but he kept standing there.
Not everybody saw him as a great hero. You know, he was attacked, he had brickbats thrown at him. Then there were people who actually did start listening to him. He still had this kind of moral power. And amazingly, some of these gangster guys did start to sit down and listen to him and even lay down their arms.
Jugal Chandra Ghosh's life would be changed by Gandhi's words.
I was convinced. I took to the streets to spread the teachings of Gandhi.
Such is the power of his words that some actually come over and lay down their arms in front of him. There are others, of course, who don't listen, but he does have a terrific impact on the city, where he's able to stall the violence that could have happened. And that's quite unique, that's quite amazing.
But 1,000 miles west of Bengal, in Punjab's ancient capital, Lahore, there's no one working to bring calm to the streets. Neighborhoods are being barricaded along religious lines. Ordinary people are being turned into soldiers. One of them is a baker who has been recruited by a local police officer gone rogue. His name is Taj Deen. He's a well-known character in his neighborhood who runs a popular naan stall. But this week, he's been caught up in the religious hatred that's spread throughout Lahore.
Taj Deen and other men being addressed by a policeman.
The policeman Maksud told us that our Muslim brothers and sisters were being killed. He told us that if we died fighting against non-Muslims, we would be martyrs. And if we'd survived, we'd be soldiers of Allah.
Why would somebody just carrying on a normal profession in their daily lives be suddenly eager to kill as many members of the other community as they wish to? That, in a sense, for us, seems like madness.
The main objectives of our training were to protect Muslims and to take revenge.
It's one of the really dark mysteries at the heart of partition is why ordinary people could turn into killers. I think the best answer that we have is that people were just so whipped up through demonization of the other and the sense that you have to kill or be killed, that they were fooling themselves into thinking they were killing in self-defense.
During this week, Taj Deen has been transformed from a baker into a killer. He's leading an attack on a local Sikh temple, hoping to kill as many of the enemy as he can.
It was pitch dark when we stormed the Sikh temple. I led the advance party. We gave a battle cry, shouting, "Long live Pakistan." Suddenly, one of them appeared. He struck me with a blow. But in hand-to-hand combat, I managed to kill him.
Partition turns just regular people into killers. And that's a chilling thing to think of.
Well, there were 20 to 36 hiding out in the temple, men, women and children.
If you're caught up in those times, that is the only way in which you can defend your community. Attack becomes the only form of defense.
All of them perished. I think I killed 4.
This is not to justify, of course, what went on, but this is what was going through people's minds.
Thursday, 14th August.
At the end of today, Britain's 200-year-long rule of India will be over.
One day until partition.
Pakistan claims the transfer of British power as Mr. Jinnah, Governor General of the New Dominion, arrives at the Constituent Assembly in Karachi.
On the morning of August 14th, 1947, just hours before partition is official, Lord Mountbatten celebrates the birth of the world's first Muslim state, Pakistan.
Addressing the Assembly, Lord Mountbatten first read a message from the King. I send you my greetings and warmest wishes.
Jinnah is happy that he's achieved a separate state. But at the same time, there's this lingering doubt because Pakistan is really kind of trying to rise from the ashes at this time. I mean, it's not actually a fully functioning state. 1 in 5 people is a refugee in West Pakistan. So there's a paradox there because on the one hand, people want to celebrate independence, but at the same time, it's staring them in the face that millions have been moved and this terrible death and destruction, and that it's not just being done to them, they've also been acting out and involved in that violence themselves.
At midnight, India will become independent.
Our people were rejoicing, ready to welcome the long-awaited liberty. There was unbounded joy.
After decades of doing everything they could to make sure this day would never come, the British have planned an elaborate handover ceremony tomorrow in Delhi. But for the 100,000 refugees crowding into camps across the capital, there is little to celebrate. These refugees, who've lost so much in the run-up to independence, don't fit in with the upbeat narrative of the day.
The British were, of course, keen to orchestrate these images of a smooth transfer of power. You know, the whole thing was so well orchestrated, it was a spectacle. But in reality, these smooth narratives of transfer of power really need to be placed alongside these individual stories of trauma, of uprootment, of migration, of violence, of killings and murder. And this was the reality of what was going on in some parts of India.
Among those taking shelter at Delhi's main refugee camp at Purana Qila is Arghwani Begum. She's 9 months pregnant with her third child. Arghwani had grown up in luxury in the northeast of India, a Muslim, waited on by a staff of loyal Hindu servants.
Our house was built in the old style. We even had stuffed tigers on the wall. We had Hindus working on our farm and their wives were always around the house. There was never any tension between any of us. Those were the days.
But this week, she had to flee after hearing that a gang was coming to ransack her home. Escaping to Pakistan, Arghwani is forced to witness the horrors of partition.
They were killing people on our train. The killing spree lasted for a while. I heard screams and cries of panic. It was horrifying. There were a lot of people, especially children, killed. I saw their bloodied bodies with my own eyes. But our compartment was safe, thanks to Allah.
Arghwani and her family have to stop in Delhi and take refuge at the camp in Purana Qila.
We arrived at the fort. There was panic, pandemonium, no food or water. You could hear the screams from the families when someone died. There were no coffins. It was terrible. I wasn't supposed to give birth for a couple of weeks. But I suppose that the trauma of being in that camp made me go into labor. I gave birth to my third child at the camp.
Argwani in the throes of labor in a makeshift tent.
It was a boy. There were no clothes for the baby. He had to be draped in one of my daughter's frocks.
It is the night of August the 14th, 1947. The auspicious moment is on its way. In every house throughout the land, the lamps of good fortune are lighted to illumine the path to freedom.
At midnight, Jawaharlal Nehru prepares to address his new nation. In Lahore, a city under curfew, the Hindu writer Fikrat Thonsvi listens to Nehru on the radio.
At the stroke of the midnight hour, when the world sleeps, India will awake to life and freedom. Long years ago, we made a tryst with destiny.
The whole night, the rages screamed, freedom, freedom. Today we're free of white's imperialism. My friend Muntah said, are you unhappy at getting freedom? I said, yes, we should welcome this. We'll greet it with the piles of dead bodies of Hindus and Muslims and Sikhs, with burning buildings and murderous bombs.
Friday, 15th August, 1947, Partition Day. Crowds of men cheering on the streets.
On the 15th of August, 1947, Britain's Indian Empire was over. India and Pakistan were now independent, although the border between them, the Radcliffe Line, would still not be announced for another 2 days. Britain proclaimed to the world that the handover of power had been a great success.
Tumultuous crowds filled the streets, celebrating, singing and laughing. Police were called out many times to restore order, where everyone ran wild with joy.
Independence meant different things for different people. For the Indian elite, independence was a great moment of celebration. But for the poverty-stricken man who's been uprooted, who's migrated over miles, who has lost his means of livelihood, lost property, what does independence mean? It means absolutely nothing.
One of the legacies of partition was the way in which violence scaled up, from being about individuals, about families, about conflict between communities and religions, into something much bigger. Violence between armies, violence between nations.
This 1 week transform the world we live in today. If you look at Pakistan and India right now, this border that was created in this week is the most dangerous border in the world.
In 1947, even though some people foresaw violence and foresaw difficulty, I don't think really very many people foresaw how bad relations between India and Pakistan would continue to be. I think a lot of people thought that actually it would all blow over and they would be friends again. As we can see, tragically, that has not happened.
For me, the tragedy is that the war has never ended. It's really become a cold war. At times it's been a hot war. There have been 3 wars between the countries. So really, we're still seeing that fight that went on in 1947 replayed and replayed. It's never really come to an end. The memories of that time still echo and rebound now in that relationship between the two countries.